This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to Cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, which is an edition of Intelligent Medicine where we answer your questions. Listener questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com, and we will select your questions if they are appropriate. Sometimes the questions get a little too esoteric or too complex to answer in a succinct format like this Q&A recording. But in general, we will eventually get to your questions, so please keep trying. Questions related to medicine and nutrition and natural therapies, that's right in our wheelhouse. And so today, of course, my co-presenter is Layla Mutin, Hoffman Center nutritionist. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And what's new this week?
I think there's a lot of pollen in the air, but I don't think that's very new.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of people's getting a little bit congested. I think I've got a little bit of spring allergy going on.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so so let's get to our questions.
Yes.
What's going on?
Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Could you discuss common drug and supplement interactions or recommend really good resources? My pharmacist and MD don't have a number of the supplements that I take in their database. That's not surprising.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of resources for drug-to-drug interaction, and, you know, physician's desk reference obviously is helpful. But the one for drugs and supplements is Dr. Leo Gallen's site.
Right.
PillAdvised.com. That's PillAdvised.com. He shows drug and nutrient interactions, but he does not show drug to drug. You could go to other sources for that.
Right.
Like drugs.com. But I find it wonderful.
Yes. And the other thing that he points out is not just where supplements interfere with the effects of drugs and vice versa, where drugs interfere with he also shows where drugs interfere with supplement mm-hmm. absorption or utilization, an example of which might be metformin, which results in people requiring more vitamin B12, or the
folate.
PPIs, the mm-hmm. drugs for ulcers, and GERD, acid-blocking medications, which necessitate more magnesium. But he also points out where there's a beneficial effect. So, for example, if you're taking some sort of medication for a medical condition, you might get an added boost by taking a certain supplement.
Right, right. So visit Dr. Gallen's website. That's PillAdvised.com, PillAdvised.com. Good
yes,
luck with
indeed.
That.
And Dr. Gallen is a frequent guest on Intelligent Medicine, and he'll make a visit this month to talk to us a little bit about Pill Advised. But I want him to focus on Lyme disease because that's an area that he's really doing a lot of pioneering research in.
Yeah, there's a lot more Lyme disease.
Indeed.
Okay. Our next question is from David. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I have some or what mimics diabetic neuropathy, and I was told to take B12, but my levels are off the scale, almost 2,000, and he takes the methylated version
right.
of them. This is his question. Is there a test that can show how much B12 is actually getting into the tissues, not just circulating in the blood?
Okay, this is a useful question because, I actually was asked a question like this on a radio show this weekend where I was the guest. I went down to the radio studio of Dr. David Samadi, he's on Fox News as a TV commentator, but before he goes on TV with Fox, he does a radio program. And he found that there was a great... He's a general physician, does a general medical show, but he found that there was just a tremendous surge of interest in vitamins. So he invited me down as an expert, and we discussed this. And so the question was, you know, how do you measure, you know, how do you know whether you should be taking certain vitamins? Mm-hmm. So really the answer is at several levels. One is we sometimes prescribe vitamins on the basis of symptoms regardless of blood levels. So we know, for example, that supercharging B12 levels, even if the blood levels are okay, can have a beneficial effect on certain conditions. So, mm-hmm. for example, if somebody develops Bell's palsy, which is a neurological, like a paralysis, a droopy face, they might do well with B12 shots because we're really trying to nourish the nerve with higher levels of B12. Or someone is suffering from fatigue. We might do a trial of high-dose oral or even B12 shots because some people respond even if they're not deficient. In terms of measuring, you know, he's right. If you take B12, generally you're going to have a high blood level of B12.
Yeah.
There's what's called a functional test for B12, which is the methylmalonic acid test. There's also transcobalamin, which is less commonly ordered. And these tests sometimes give you an indication, even if the B12 appears to be normal in a regular blood test, whether, you know, these functional tests may tell us if the B12 is being utilized. But really when it comes down to, the good question is, what's in the cell? We're measuring what's in the blood.
Right.
So, for example, magnesium is an intracellular nutrient. We know that the vast majority of magnesium in the body lives inside the cells. So when we measure magnesium in the bloodstream, that may not reflect what's actually in the cells.
That's not actually very helpful at all. Maybe the red blood cell, the RBC magnesium,
the red blood cell magnesium is intended to get at that, but the problem is when blood sits around for a while, I mean, if you could get it like right to the lab and immediately have the lab run the test, you know, like you have the lab literally in your, you know, in your office, you know, where you draw the blood, that might yield better results. But
that's
frankly, when blood cells sit around, they will leak some of their magnesium into the surrounding plasma. And I guess you could spin them down, but still, you know, it's not quite accurate.
Okay.
So,
methylmalonic acid.
Then. Yeah, but sometimes it's a clinical thing. You know, it's a judgment call. Like, we might give additional B12 to someone. Again, use the example of someone who's on a medication that depletes B12, like an acid blocker or metformin. We might just take more B12.
Right.
And or we might do an empirical trial of B12 in a fatigue patient. We might say, well, your fatigue, your B12 is a little low. I know it's not deficient, but once you take some B12, they'll come back and they'll say, wow, I really feel better. That's like, you know, supercharging the B12.
Okay. Do you prefer an injection of B12 is better than the oral?
Well, you're going to achieve higher blood levels with an injection. However, it's actually been pointed out that even patients who have pernicious anemia, it used to be thought they absolutely had to take B12 in a shot form. But it's now been shown that even in pernicious anemia, that taking it daily, especially high-dose form, you know, 1 or 2 milligrams of methylcobalamin will usually bypass the malabsorption.
Wow.
Especially, you know, you can take it sublingually. There's nasal B12 that may bypass the area of the gastrointestinal tract, which is affected by pernicious anemia.
David, thank you for your question, and best of luck to you. All right. Our next question is from Christopher. He says, I can't absorb iron, and I receive about 1,500 milligram infusions every 6 months or so. I would be interested in trying your slow-release iron per your recommendation. Do you think that would work for me?
The answer is probably not, because there are, for various reasons, people have difficulty absorbing iron. Sometimes it's genetic. Sometimes it's due to a medication that people are taking. And sometimes it's due to something like celiac disease, which causes malabsorption of iron. Somebody who's not responding to a diet that is high in iron or iron pills, you have to either make sure they're not bleeding, you know, do the whole GI workup, and you know, even sometimes they'll swallow a camera to see if the area between the upper endoscopy and the lower endoscopy where they don't, you know, you can't get the scope, there might be some bleeding there. So that's why the people swallow the camera. If there's no bleeding that can be found, then there's some problem with absorbing the iron, and that might be due to celiac disease. But there are some genetic conditions where people are poor absorbers of iron. So you know, I kind of doubt that the slow, what was the slow the iron, slow the slow iron. FE, mm-hmm. Is going to, you know, work when all other oral forms of iron did not.
I wonder then, Christopher should get checked for celiac disease if he has, if he hadn't already.
It would be truly malpractice if he were not. Yeah. You know, to get iron infusions without investigating that really is dumb.
Right. Okay. Christopher, we hope you're listening. So follow up with that. That would be the way to go. Thank you for your question. This question, Dr. Hoffman, comes from Gabe. I'm tapering off methadone. What supplements do you recommend? Is vitamin C useful? What about Propax with NT factor?
Wow, okay. You know, this is a very challenging, and we like to support people with addictions.
Yeah.
And, you know, methadone, of course, being a substitute for heroin, it's a legal prescribed medication.
But it's just as addictive, isn't it?
Oh, it's totally addictive, and it's hard to get off of. Well, the way that it is better than heroin is it's not a street drug. Okay. It's a pure drug, so it's not adulterated. It can be taken orally, so you don't have to inject it with needles. It's super powerful. It's sometimes used for patients with cancer, but it's also used as sort of a step down for heroin addicts to get them off criminal activity, to get them off the danger of injection and the unreliability of the heroin, which is often spiked with harmful substances. They just put them on methadone. Yeah. And you can actually live your entire life taking methadone. It doesn't, it makes you sort of a little bit stoned. Mm-hmm. But people who rely on methadone, they just get right with it. They're so used to it that they just get right with it. They're pretty functional, and their health is not horribly undermined by it. And there are literally tens of thousands of people, not hundreds of thousands of people, who take methadone on programs like this. So getting off of it, you're going to go through withdrawal. I mean, the classic example of that is the Frank Sinatra movie, Monkey on My Back. Oh, no, Man with a Golden Arm, it's called. Uh-huh. It shows him going through he won an Oscar for that.
Wow.
It shows him going through the throes of withdrawal. You know, he's got a kick. They lock him in a room. It's that classic movie thing where he's kicking and screaming and begging, to be let out. And they practice tough love on him, and he withdraws. Because you go through a horrible physical withdrawal. Mm-hmm. So how do you counteract that with vitamins? Well, there's no vitamin that has, a heroin-like effect.
Right.
So that's not, we're not going to get that. But it is thought that withdrawal from addiction can be supported. There's a woman who is a doctor who wrote a very influential book, I think it was in the 80s, Joan Matthews Larson out of Minneapolis, who runs a center for alcohol detox and addiction detox that's based on natural principles. I mean, it's based on psychological principles, but also she uses nutrients, vitamins, and supplements. And so I imagine she would make sure that people have adequate levels of various B vitamins, perhaps some neurotransmitter support, perhaps some omega-3 fatty acids and magnesium to make them more comfortable during the withdrawal, the inevitable withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Because I imagine that if you're nutritionally depleted, it's got to be a lot worse than withdrawal.
Yeah.
So, let's provide people with good nutritional support. They're still going to go through withdrawal.
Right, right.
But
being low in the B vitamins and magnesium
You sometimes recommend glutamine for patients who are trying to get off of alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol and sugar.
Right.
Well, the research is there for alcohol and for sugar cravings, so glutamine can be great.
L-glutamine, like powder, like maybe a teaspoon two or three times a day.
Exactly, or even more than that. If they're taking the capsules, they could take 1,500 milligrams three times, actually more like 4,500 milligrams. Three times a day. As many as three capsules three times a day.
Well, a teaspoon is about 3 to 5 grams, anyway, so depending. That's something that we might suggest you try, you don't have a lot to lose, and it might be beneficial, although I have to say that's such a terrible problem that there's not a nutritional fix that will dramatically ease the
But what you
pangs
said, you
of,
know,
of withdrawal.
Even the anxiety, the depression, you know, neurotransmitter support, as you said, the B vitamins, magnesium can help take, hopefully, the edge off a little bit.
Yeah, there's even some people who have proposed intravenous vitamin C and, you know, with B vitamins and magnesium. That might not be a bad idea. Intravenous vitamins might be even more powerful and effective.
What is that, the medically induced detox that they do where you go to sleep for two or three
Yeah,
days?
That's, it's like under some sort of anesthesia with a...
Would they even do that for methadone?
Rapid withdrawal. Yes, they can. They can. They can.
That's an option, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've met some doctors who swear by it, but it's also, it sounds like a sort of a potentially dangerous rapid process where... You have to be in pretty good cardiovascular condition to undertake it.
Wow, okay. Gabe, good for you for tapering off methadone. Best of luck to you. That's quite the undertaking.
Right.
Okay. This comes from Marie. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, my question is about DHEA. My gynecologist wants to give me DHEA and pregnenolone to help with insomnia.
Holistic gynecologist.
Yeah. Marie is 58 years old. She started noticing some hair loss, and she wants to know, can you tell me if DHEA and pregnenolone, if monitored correctly and given in the correct dose, will still cause hair loss?
Yeah, and the answer is absolutely yes, because it's different strokes for different folks.
Mm-hmm.
Some women at very low doses of DHEA, perhaps even 5 milligrams, which are very conservative dosing, they'll say that they notice hair thinning.
Yeah.
Now, when I say that to me,
or
I
even
say...
Even the hairline receding.
Yeah, I say... Well, guess what? You know, my DHEA is like, you know, 10 times higher than yours.
Mm-hmm.
And then I show up my hairline, which is very unreceding, but that's genetic. That's
right.
Just genetic. I mean, with a normal testosterone and a fairly high DHEA, because I take 25 to 50 milligrams of DHEA every day, I'm not getting hair recession. But that's just genetic. I just, you know, I'm not genetically prone to hair recession. If you have the gene as a man or a woman, that promotes androgenic alopecia, then by taking an androgen, you will encourage that. So as to pregnenolone's a precursor for many different hormones, and it's hard to know where it goes.
I see.
So I'm not sure that it's the DHEA or the pregnenolone. I know I'm not that familiar with the pregnenolone's effects on the hair because I don't prescribe it.
I wonder if Marie would benefit from taking saw palmetto at the same time?
Saw palmetto is a partial blocker. You know, a lot of women now are being, if they're postmenopausal and they're not likely to get pregnant, they can take Propecia, which is the male anti-balding drug. It's just very, very strictly controlled for women because if, God forbid, you get pregnant on that, just the birth defects are horrendous.
Which should tell you a lot about that drug
there. Which should tell you a lot about the drug. I mean, that hormones are... important. And, you know, in men who take Propecia, there's a fairly significant percentage of them who experience erectile dysfunction or mood changes because it cuts down on, not all testosterone, but it cuts down on
dehydrotestosterone,
which is something that actually has an effect on the brain and perhaps on sexual functioning.
Yeah. So maybe saw palmetto, maybe biotin. If she's not taking biotin, that might be.
You know, we could go to any number of things that are helpful for hair, but the best thing is if the DHEA is causing hair loss, is to not take the DHEA. And then there's that 7-keto DHEA, which is supposed to not have the side effects of the androgenic, you know, problems.
I've heard of that,
but I don't know that. You know, the research is really limited on that, and I don't know if it offers the same benefits as DHEA.
What I find interesting, Dr. Hoffman, is her gynecologist gave these to her, the DHEA, the pregnenolone, to help with insomnia. I would question first if Marie's overdoing caffeine soda or chocolate.
Pregnenolone and DHEA, to me, are not extraordinarily good for insomnia. I mean, they might help, but... Yeah. More likely, progesterone would help in some as a hormone.
Yeah, that would be more sedating, right? Okay.
Progesterone is sedating, and we often use it in women at the time of menopause who have sleep problems, and it really fixes the sleep problems.
Best of luck, Marie. Okay. We have a question from Mike. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, please help us understand more about aluminum. We've heard you say we should not use cookware, antiperspirants that contain aluminum. How does it affect our health? Does it build up in our bodies over time? How can we remove it from our system? When I cut myself shaving, should I refrain from using an aluminum sulfate stick to stop the bleed? A styptic pencil, right. Yeah.
Right. Well, okay, so there's a great deal of controversy about aluminum. The way that this first was recognized is that dialysis patients underwent dialysis, and the dialysate, you know, the blood's taken out of the body, it's run through a machine to filter it out, basically, to clean it, you know, just like the kidney cleans the blood. Mm-hmm. And then it's circulated back into the patient. And the dialysate, I don't know if it still is, but it used to be full of aluminum.
Wow.
So the filter was full of aluminum, and the aluminum then got reintroduced into the patient. Mm-hmm. So what they found is that there was a high degree of dementia in patients who are on dialysis.
Wow.
Now, it was also found that they had high levels of aluminum, obviously, because it was pumped into their bodies. So the question is whether the aluminum caused the dementia. And in fact, if you look at Alzheimer brains, there are what are called fibrillary tangles, which are high in aluminum content. Now, just a little pushback against the theory that it's aluminum's fault. Any time you get a sick organ, it's going to act as a sponge for anything that's toxic.
So that's interesting.
So, for example, they found that in heart failure, the level of cadmium, the level of lead, the level of mercury in the heart is much higher. Now, does that mean that, you know, got to be scientific about it? It's like, well, you can say, well, that's the cause of heart failure. Well, it is possibly to some extent, but also devitalized tissue, the brain isn't working or the heart isn't working.
Becomes a depot for these
toxins? It becomes a depot. It just doesn't have the ability to pump out these toxins or resist these toxins, and it just gets deposited there. So the question is, did the aluminum cause the problem, or is the aluminum a sign of the problem to begin with? Because we know that dialysis patients are pretty sick. Yeah. They do have a lot of cardiovascular disease. They have lots of, you know, health problems, basically. Mm-hmm. And the toxicity from renal failure and a high BUN and improper elimination of toxins can affect their brains and accelerate dementia. So is it, you know, so we don't know. So, this was a popular notion from the beginning of my practice in holistic medicine. Is in the 80s this issue came up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we still tell patients to do that, but, you know, is it the proximate cause of Alzheimer's disease? There are plenty of people who probably are really careful about, their aluminum consumption, and they still go on to develop dementia. So it's a multifaceted problem.
That's interesting.
You know, all these heavy metals are bad for you. So we try to minimize our exposure to lead, to mercury, to cadmium, to aluminum.
And a way to detox that could be from chelation therapy.
Well, problem is chelation therapy is not that good for aluminum. Aluminum is very tenacious. It's really hard to get out.
Even with the urine toxic metal test and the oral chelation?
Yeah, it's not that effective. So, you know, the best way to deal, is to prevent it.
My understanding is we absorb more through our skin than via our cooking utensils.
Well, most effective deodorants are the ones that contain aluminum hydroxide. Yeah. And people who are sweating like crazy, they're very tempted to use those things. But there is some aluminum absorption through the skin when that happens. Now, do we see an epidemic of Alzheimer's disease in people who are sweaters who use aluminum hydroxide deodorants? Well, maybe a study needs to be done.
Hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah, but and then the aluminum cookware thing, you know, aluminum cookware has advantages. It's very light. It's inexpensive.
Good conductor of heat.
Pretty good conductor of heat. But should we be using it? And, you know, one way to mitigate that is to use aluminum cookware that's sealed, hopefully with non-toxic chemical coatings. And also, if you're going to use something that's made with aluminum, is not to use make a tomato puree in there.
Yes.
Because the acidity of certain things leaches the metal.
Right.
And so, I don't use aluminum cookware anymore. I haven't for a long time.
I don't either.
I forget when the last time I used it. That's a joke. That's a joke. I can't even remember the last time I used aluminum. So I want to get you coffee. Okay. Okay, so this is a good point at which to pause so that you can have a glass of water. And we will then continue with part two. Give us a preview of part two.
Let's see. Is long-term use of olive leaf extract going to cause bacterial resistance?
Good question. We will address that question in just a moment when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.